from WXXI News. You should be hearing me. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2006 with the release of a memoir titled Eat, Pray, Love. Elizabeth Gilbert wrote the book to detail her journey of self-discovery, and Eat, Pray, Love became a mega hit. Time magazine called her one of the 100 most influential writers in the world. The book became a movie starring Julia Roberts. The concept was simple. Young woman, married with a nice house, sees parts of her life fall apart, divorce, big changes. She does what any struggling young woman would do in the situation, travel the world for a year, eating food in Italy for 4 months, praying in Bali, you know, the usual. And then she becomes a wiser person, and through her writing, we are all wiser ourselves. Or something. I confess I couldn't get through the book, and I don't seek to denigrate it. Maybe you read it, maybe you loved it. The offense to me felt a little contrived to create a narrative rather than a real lived experience. And maybe I'm wrong. Tens of thousands of readers, even Oprah, love to Eat, Pray, Love. This week, Elizabeth Gilbert wrote a column for the New York Times Magazine titled Confessions of a Seduction Addict. She admits that she wrecked her own life by becoming addicted to the thrill of being sexually wanted by unavailable men. She targeted men in marriages or long-term relationships. She loved the feeling of making them come after her when they shouldn't. When she was successful, she typically moved on to another man, and at one point she was in the process of getting a divorce while also breaking up with a lover. For the Eat, Pray, Love readers, it led to new questions. Was Gilbert manipulative to sell books? Had she left out major details in her first memoir? What are the rules for memoirs? What should we expect as readers? This hour, I've invited a roundtable of writers to share their experience and views on memoirs. Yesterday, we talked about whether it's okay to alter photographs for news purposes. I want to know whether it's okay to alter events for memoirs. My guests for the hour include Gregory Girard, who is a teacher of creative writing at Writers and Books. He's the author of In Jupiter's Shadow, a memoir that we talked about on this program, a book that I enjoyed very much, and it's nice to have you back here, Greg.
Thanks, Evan.
Also here is Sonia Livingston, whose first book, Ghost Bread, is a memoir set in Rochester. Is that right, Sonia?
It is.
Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Jenny Lloyd's here, and Jenny is an English native who is a retired history professor from the college at Brockport, and hoping to publish in the fall your own writing. Tell me a little bit about it, Jenny.
Well, it's a memoir of growing up on a farm in England in the 1940s and 1950s. It includes my experiences in World War II when I was a child, small child, and also my experiences at boarding school.
Mm-hmm. And so we'll talk a little bit more about not only your book, but your views on memoir, along with Elizabeth Osta, who is here. She is the recent author of an Irish historical novel called Jeremiah's Hunger, and currently writing a memoir. And the memoir that you are writing is about what?
Its working title is Saving Faith, and it's about my 9 years in the convent.
All right. See? So you've got a broad array of memoirs, and if you don't remember, or if you missed the conversation on this program a few months ago with Greg Girard about his memoir, In Jupiter's Shadow is about Greg growing up, going to school at McQuaid here in Rochester. Greg is gay and wrestled with his own identity, especially from the perspective of someone who felt the pressure of being in a school and maybe in a kind of day-to-day environment where that wasn't always viewed as acceptable. Greg, how would you describe it?
It was a mixed bag. I mean, there was the subtle unacceptable messages that came out, and then which led to just a lot of hiding and a lot of public happiness and all of the interactions that you do that are approved of, and then all of the secret shame that's inside.
So we'll talk about all of the different memoirs and the authors who are part of this roundtable this hour, but I want to start with this. How many in this table have read Eat, Pray, Love? Again, I started and didn't finish. We've got two of the four. Jenny?
Yes, I've read it, yes.
And what did you think?
I enjoyed it. I read it because the first part's in Italy, and I lived in Italy for 4 years, so I tend to read things about Italy. I enjoyed that part more than the others. It didn't lead me to read her second book.
Interesting. And so she's got another book coming out this fall. So let's also find out what Elizabeth thought. You read the book. What did you think?
I did, and I agree with you. It was difficult to get through to the end. I hung in there with it, but it wasn't rewarding.
And why do you say that?
I enjoyed Italy very much. I enjoyed the middle section, but then toward the end, I heard it all. It was like the same repetitious story.
And I don't mean to invalidate the author's experience. I've never met the author of Eat, Pray, Love. But I'm curious to know, now that she's written this piece this week for New York Times Magazine, Confessions of a Seduction Addict, some of her readers have said, wait a second, you didn't exactly write Eat, Pray, Love from the perspective of someone who was wrecking marriages and sort of addicted to a sexual thrill and was very self-destructive that way, and now you're kind of coming out and admitting that, and they feel somewhat manipulated. Jenny, do you?
No, I did read the article, and I actually thought that it was what happened before she went into what she did in Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah.
So it didn't, I didn't feel manipulated.
Okay. Did you?
I didn't. I was, as Jenny said, when she opened, I thought, this woman's led a life. I got that in the very beginning of the book. And I didn't need to know at that time what it was. Now, as I go retrospectively, I think she could have enhanced it by sharing some of this.
Okay. Before we get to some of your phone calls, I see the phone already ringing as we talk about this and memoirs, et cetera. That leads to that broader conversation about what really constitutes the rules of memoir. And Greg Girard, I looked. There's not an actual set of rules for memoirs. but you're someone who teaches writing, and you've also written memoirs. So where do we start with that?
That is true. It's somewhat of a new genre, per se. And so the rules are somewhat still being defined, I would say, in some ways. I mean, you have traditional nonfiction, in my opinion, and I'm sure the other wonderful authors around the table can chime in on this. You know, you had your traditional nonfiction, which was this happened in a very factual, maybe journalistic or biography type style writing. And then you had your fiction, which was your Stephen King and your whatever. So this memoir has grown about the truth of people's stories. I often get the question asked in my classes, what is truth, or how much are you allowed to bend things, or what are you telling? So the general rule is, if it happened, it's told. If it didn't happen, you don't put it in. So that's kind of the rule that I go by. I think some people take a more strict opinion of that and a less strict. What I do prescribe to, which I know there's some controversy about this, is whether, and I have a friend who's a memoir author who said, you know, when you're telling a story of yourself, it's like 800 pages long. Because people, you know, you know so many details and so many things happen in our lives. Just telling the story of one day takes a lot. So you have a responsibility to the reader to try to deliver the story in a format that's maybe 300 pages and readable. So you select and choose, maybe fold some events together or fold characters together. To me, I am okay with that, but I like to see, if that happens, I need to see an acknowledgement at the beginning of the memoir of what exactly has taken place. You know, this is the best of my memory to my recollection. And I appreciate that memory is a fluid thing. We all five are going to sit around this table and remember this differently. So it's subjective, I guess.
Okay. So before I go around the table then and get the panel slot, because we all may have different lines on where the rules are. First of all, I totally agree with you, Greg. I always appreciate when someone says, these events are true the best I remember them, or at least give me that sign that says, because it's implied, but I want to see it in writing, that I'm not fabricating here, that you can trust what you're about to read. I remember reading a book called A Course Called Ireland. A creative writing teacher named Tom Coyne wrote it. He went to Ireland and spent a summer there and decided he wanted to play every golf course that was on the sea, and he would only walk to get there, even in between towns. And the book really became about interacting with Irish villages, his time on the road, etc. Fascinating book, and he opened the book with a note like that that included a line that said, some of the order of events has changed to create a narrative, but the events are true. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, I would be okay with that. So, yeah, I think, again, you know, and I don't want to be disingenuous to the genre. I think that a good story is a good story. We tell our stories, and maybe story is the wrong word, because these are the true stories of our lives, the narrative of our lives. So that implies nonfiction. It implies this something really happened. But if you're going to, it's just how much you're going to tweak, I guess, is the bottom line.
I don't think it would be okay to change the order of events if the content or narrative changed as a result. And let me just fabricate a totally extreme example here. there is a death, and then separately there is a suicide. One comes before the other. You better be right about that. You can't misorder that.
I would absolutely. I'd be on board with you on that, because if you're manipulating the events to try to increase the drama or something like that, I'd be way against that. I don't think that's appropriate at all.
Okay, there you go. Sonia, you reacted a little bit. We talked about ordering events. What are some of the rules that you would lay out? Are you okay with changing the order of events, for example?
I think you can do anything like that, excuse me, as long as the writer is upfront with the reader. So it's all about getting that reader to trust you. When you say this is memoir or nonfiction, to me that's the equivalent of sitting with somebody and hearing their stories. And we don't expect that person in the waiting room to tell their whole lives, but what they tell, we want to know that we can believe. And so if somebody says upfront, I change the order, that's fine with me. I teach creative writing at the graduate level, and I teach nonfiction memoir specifically, and I can tell you that graduate students and people at conferences, professional conferences, spend hours debating this very question. But to me, it's pretty clear. Memoir is based on memory. If you don't remember it, it doesn't belong in that book. It belongs in a book of fiction.
Okay. Jenny?
Well, I'm a historian. and historians can't make up things. It's the basic rule. And so I'm not okay with making up things. I am, however, okay to say that certain things have been changed to protect people or something like that.
Which was true in Greg's memoir, yes, Greg? Yeah.
True.
Okay, yeah. So that was true there, yeah. And true in many, many, yep.
Yes, and I agree with Sonia that you have a responsibility to your audience. They have to trust you, and that means that you don't make things up. You tell it as you remember it. But, of course, it's also true that it's your memory. Everything is filtered through that person's brain. And, for example, my brother doesn't remember things in the same way I do. I have a truth and he has a truth. So I think that I'm pretty strict about not making things up, but there's a little latitude around the edges.
What about changing the order of events?
I'm not with changing the order of events.
Okay. See, I like a little disagreement on the panel. I find this healthy. Elizabeth Osta?
I remember vividly the issue that arose with James Frey's book, and he going back on Oprah's show and admitting that, yes, he had made a mistake and trying to publicly apologize. At that time, I knew a young man who was in recovery who read the book and saw through it immediately, and I thought, there it is right there. When there's truth in the story, as someone remembers it, that resonates. When there's not truth, it doesn't resonate. So if you can remember and tell the story as best you remember it authentically, you're going to create that connection with the audience that Sonia spoke of. If not, there's always going to be that little disconnect. Another example I think of is Katharine Hepburn's story, My Life. I love Katharine Hepburn. I want to say, who doesn't? And when I read that book, I was terribly disappointed because I knew in her life that she had a brother who died when she was 7 years old, and I wanted so much to read about that event. And two paragraphs were given to his death. Mm. And, of course, it may have been told to, but that kind of missing piece to me was a reason she couldn't do it. I don't know. But I'd love to have read the truth of that.
Talking about memoir, the rules of memoir, and the experiences of our panel this hour, all writers themselves with their own interesting backgrounds. And I want to start with some of your phone calls and questions and comments that have already come in. And we'll jump on the phone first with Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Oh, hello. How you doing?
Good.
I have just a real comment, a quick comment. I have a problem with the changing of order because the order that you experience things changes your experience. So would you, like if I say that I liked this better and it was the first thing, how can I say I liked it better than the thing that I had the second? You know what I mean? Those experiences that come together. And I found Eat, Pray, Love a bit contrived myself, and just a real comment on the addiction she had. Addiction is such a simple and easy way out, and I think it's a way overused word, and that sort of annoys me. So she loses credibility with me when she goes through that easy way out instead of taking responsibility and say, you know what? I was egotistical and I did what I did.
Yeah, narcissistic and totally lacking in moral core. How about that?
And it has nothing to do with an addiction. And I'm tired of people wanting to get off and escape issues through using that word.
Rich, thank you for the phone call. It's an interesting point, and the issue of addiction is not one that I want to try to adjudicate for Elizabeth Gilbert right here, and it's one that we'll talk about on a separate hour with actual addiction counselors. And there are, I know there are different kinds of addiction. There's sexual addiction. There's all kinds of different things. So I don't want to try to dismiss or adjudicate that. I do agree that when you read the piece that Elizabeth Gilbert wrote this week for New York Times Magazine, again, it's called Confessions of a Seduction Addict, it does seem to downplay. Nowhere in there are the words, I'm sorry, for intentionally trying to go after men who are married without sort of regard for the consequences. She admits that she was wrong to do it. I think she should have said she was sorry, and I think you got to own it a little bit better. But, but Rich brings up that point about the order of events. So, Greg, I understand his point on the order of events and why he's not okay with changing some of the order. I also think that you'd have to understand case by case. I don't think Greg Girard is saying, if it changes your experience but it makes for a better story, go ahead and change it, right?
No, I wouldn't agree. Yeah, I would not do that.
Okay, so I'm trying to think of examples where changing the order of events doesn't actually change the content, the experience, because I do think that that is possible. But offhand, I do take the point. Jenny Lloyd, you want to weigh in on what Rich was saying there?
I think that changing the order of events does change it, because you're making a narrative and you're trying to make a narrative that is, true to you anyway. And if you change the order of events, it's not exactly as you experienced it. It's a way that you've decided to change your experience, and you're getting closer to fiction then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, what would be the motivation or the purpose? When I wrote my own memoir, I chose to write it chronologically because it made more sense to me to get the narrative out, and then it was more cutting out events than putting things in. Mm-hmm. So I would struggle to see the purpose of changing the order.
Sonia?
I like what Jenny just said about true to you, because I'm thinking I'm okay with reading a memoir that's not in the exact order in which it happened, but I want the writer to think it happened in the order in which they wrote it. So to me, their memory, their being true to how they remember is more important than the order. So if they truly just don't remember, especially if they're writing about stressful childhood or something like that, that's fine with me, but that's not changing. That's more like following memory.
And Elizabeth?
I was thinking of the use of flashback, which I do often in my writing, and it because it comes as one's writing and thinking of an event, all of a sudden a flash comes in. That can change the order, but it also illuminates the order.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jake writes to us, in response to your first caller about changing the order of events, when reflecting on my own life, current events often recolor my past experience. A story does not need to be linear to be true.
Right, yeah. Right. And that's what I think I was trying to get to. There are many contemporary memoirs that are being written that are not at all linear. They're written as flashes, are very episodic. And those feel just as true, if not truer to me, than a linear narrative, because that is often how people remember their childhoods or whatever experiences that they're trying to render.
And I would say, and again, I'm just sort of thinking on the fly here, responding to all this, because I think there are some good arguments being made on all sides about this. I think you could probably find a way to write or to reorder the events without saying that the order is different. In other words, if you want to write about one section of things that happened to you and it overlaps with another that you're going to tackle elsewhere, I don't know, write about it on its own contained way and then write about another thing in its own contained way. If it feels in the flow like it's happening one after the next, it's different than saying this happened first, this happened second. Jenny?
Yes, in fact, my own memoir is written like that. It's written in episodes, mm-hmm. Which do move forward through time, but not necessarily in a linear fashion.
Okay. So very interesting there. And Jake, thank you for the comment. He also said, I'd like to point out memoirs are not autobiographies. Outside of fabricating events, I wouldn't imagine a memoir would have any rules. Greg Girard?
Well, again, I think it goes back to what we were talking about, the truth of your experiences and the trust that you're building with a readership. You're trying to communicate a story. In my case, I was trying to share the struggle, the intense private struggle of a gay Catholic teenager. And I wanted to share, you know, what it was like to hear the priest, you know, or see the priest raise his eyebrows when he reads the Sodom and Gomorrah story, or, you know, me in my bedroom at light on, at night reading maybe dirty magazines under the covers and things like that. Those are the real experiences. So I wouldn't want to go, I wouldn't want to make up something. And then if what would be the point? Again, if I want to write a fiction book, I'm going to write a fiction book. I'm trying to tell this truth of this struggle, and I want others to resonate with that. As Elizabeth mentioned, they're going to pick up on that. If they're a struggling gay kid, they're going to maybe resonate with those stories as authentic or not authentic. And I think once you're labeled inauthentic or you've been inauthentic, I think your whole story is suspect, and then your motivation. Are you trying to make money, or are you trying to share an experience or help the world or whatever your mission is to write that story?
Well, that's such an important point, because when I think about, and again, this may be a little unfair to a writer like Elizabeth Gilbert. She's not here to defend herself, though. I think she's done just fine for herself. But, you know, you read Eat, Pray, Love, or even when you read her column, Confessions of a Seduction Addict, it ends with this perfectly pat, to me, borderline unbelievable anecdote in which she is trying to recover from her sexual addiction. She's been going to therapy, and she describes after 6 months of celibacy, she describes bumping into a man in a park in Manhattan, and he flirts with her, and she's very attracted to him, and he invites her back to his apartment, and she says normally, of course, she would want to go, and but she asks him if she could think about it for a while, and he says sure, and he sits down on a bench and reads a magazine while she thinks about the offer, and then eventually she says, no, I don't think I'm ready for it, and he said, that's okay, let's go get Italian ice instead. You know, and she realized, now my life is better because it's more mature. It feels a little pat. So my next question then, Greg Girard, is when you're writing a memoir, and I want to ask all of you this, when you're writing a memoir, inevitably there are always moments where you could say something happened that didn't, that would be a little sexier, a little more glamorous, a little more easy to sell the book as a vehicle, and you've got to make choices. I mean, I trust all of you, the integrity of you as writers, but do you ever feel that pull? And how important is it for writers to sort of resist that? I'm not saying Elizabeth Gilbert didn't experience that. Maybe she did. It didn't feel authentic to me. What do you think?
I think it's a cliff, and I think you should stay as... I felt a seductive pull of it, sure, but then I write fiction on the other side too, so I can get that out over there. But as soon as you draw the, you know, as soon as you push the line, where does the line stop? The James Frey debacle, which put a dark spot on all of memoir as a genre, was something about he spent 4 hours in jail, and he said that he spent 46 days or something in jail. I mean, obviously he did that for a reason. And again, so where does the line? If he spent 5 hours in jail, is it okay? Is he spent six? Why not just go with what the truth is? Because I think it's just a cliff that you're going to fall off.
Sonia.
I guess I'm, of everything we've said so far, the thing that tempts me is the Italian ice that Elizabeth Gilbert had with that guy. I'm not tempted at all. I don't think about making things up. For me, it's all the creative part of, you know, getting your memory out there is how you tell it. But I love memory. I love people's true stories. I like research. You know, I like research. So to me, that pull is not there. In fact, I really worry about it. There are several famous memoirs that have been, not just James Frey, but other cases where people maybe wrote about living on an Indian reservation or in the inner city of LA or the Holocaust, only to find out that they completely fabricated it. So not only did that hurt them as writers, which, you know, we just talked about, but their cause, the thing that they say that they represented, which is often a hidden population. I wrote about growing up poor in Rochester, which is a reality that lots of people don't know about. We know about it and don't know about it. And so to make something up would not serve my purpose, but more than anything, it just doesn't tempt me.
Jenny?
I'm the only person here who is quite incapable of writing fiction. So, no, I'm not tempted.
No, I actually struggle with telling the truth in an honest way and in an authentic way. And that's the key right there, is telling the full truth and nothing but the truth.
Okay.
So help me God.
But Evan, I don't know if you'll care. We all belong to a writing group, by the way. That's how we got here today.
Oh.
Together.
That's fabulous, because we've talked on this program before about finding writing groups, and if you can find a good one, they are very, very valuable.
For sure.
But I brought up that question on the temptation, not to indicate that I thought that your work was in any way pulled in any direction, but to say that very few memoirs go gangbusters like Eat, Pray, Love. It's just not going to happen for everyone. And some of the criticism of Eat, Pray, Love from some of the biggest critics out there said that this feels, everything just feels perfect. I mean, it feels too lucky. How lucky is one person? The remarkable experiences. And some of it felt inauthentic, and it felt like it was written to be, I told Greg on the phone this morning, I said, that book was, the reason I stopped reading it was, it felt like I was reading a book that was aiming to be a Jennifer Aniston movie. It became a Julia Roberts movie. you know, it just felt a little too pat. And yet, she's set for life, Greg. She has no trouble selling books. And as perfect as it is, some people say, boy, I love that story. So if when you read a book, if it's too good to be true, or if you think, boy, this sounds too good to be true, do you stop believing it?
Well, let's talk about another memoir that was very popular, The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls. I read that book, and I ate it up. It was about growing up very poor with a very chaotic childhood with some parents who I think were pretty much mentally unbalanced. And there were some very dramatic events in that story, and from what I understand, she was criticized for possibly making things up or whether she was authentic or not. I connected with the story, and I ultimately brushed off the criticism until I read something that, you know, thoroughly disproves it. To me, it felt so real. I was very moved and affected by reading the work. So I don't know if I came up with a point there.
But let me ask you. You were obviously affected by the work. Do you feel cheapened or... those are not real experiences, does that bother you?
Yeah, if there was some investigative reporting done and they said she made up that she, you know, didn't go to the hospital when she had third-degree skin burns from the fireplace or her sister did, I would dismiss the whole thing at that point. It would just burn me. I would feel burned.
Yeah. Sonia?
Yeah, I didn't really connect to Glass Castle for that same reason we're talking about. I didn't read Eat, Pray, Love. It felt to me like it was going to be a movie, and I thought, oh, I'll just wait and see the movie. But yeah, I guess another example, because we're talking about lots of women here, I'll bring up a guy. David Sedaris. Everybody loves David Sedaris, right? But he admits that what he writes didn't necessarily happen. He admits it after people investigate and find out that it didn't happen.
See, I've had big problems with that.
Okay, because I always think he's the hero of it, and I think he's a great entertainer, but I don't like to call that nonfiction, and I don't assign it in my classes.
I agree. I think that's well said. I think he's a very good writer. I don't think he was ever nearly as good as his friend David Rakoff, who passed away, but I had a trouble with the fact that in retrospect, I don't know at all what David Sedaris wrote, which happened and what didn't. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I've got a problem. Then all of a sudden, like Greg said, I doubt all of it.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
That credibility, I guess, when that credibility is gone, Jenny, you don't really get it back necessarily.
No, you don't. At least I don't think so. Another example that I can give was if there's Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek. Tinker Creek, which is a well-known book. And it starts out very dramatically with a cat jumping through the window onto her. And somebody I know went to a conference where she was speaking, and she said she'd never owned a cat. This, to me, invalidates a lot of the other book.
Yes, she opens with a beautiful scene of the cat's paw prints being bloody and looking like rose petals on her chest. And so it's a very dramatic moment in the book. She won the Pulitzer for that book. And I teach this every semester. My students all want to go and find and get Annie Dillard, which isn't the point. But she admitted later that actually that didn't happen to her. A graduate student had that experience. And so she just put it, she thought, that's poetic. I'll open my book with it.
In some ways, it's like the Brian Williams debacle. You know, you're telling stories that didn't happen to you.
Right.
You weren't on a helicopter. Your helicopter wasn't shot down. And now, what happens to Brian Williams? Well, amazingly, NBC finds a way to keep paying him, but his credibility will never, he'll never be. He's lost his job. Right. He will not be in that position. So in some ways, it's the same kind of rule. Elizabeth?
I'm thinking that why do we read memoir? We read to be inspired and to find a way to help us through these days that we all share. And when we get to a place where someone's guiding us and then we find out they're not authentic, it's like being gypped. Mm-hmm. It's being cheated. Yeah. But when we find truths woven through people's passages because they are authentic, it helps us along the way.
Evan, let's put it back on you. You write nonfiction. You wrote about the wine trail in, mm-hmm. in Finger Lakes.
Summer
in a glass, yeah.
Summer in a glass.
So tell us, what was your experience as far as telling people's truths, and were you ever tempted to stretch the narrative to make it more interesting of a story?
In this case, I don't want to make it about the host of the show. You're the guest here, Greg. I like how you've turned it around on me. I started with 18 chapters and ended with 13 because I wanted each chapter to be its own it has to have its own narrative arc. And if you read it individually, it would be like a mini biography. And if it didn't have a narrative arc, I found myself unable to force it. So I culled four or five out because it just didn't feel like a fit, as opposed to saying, and I was sitting there at times saying, I'm so close on this, but I still don't feel like I know what the full narrative arc is. And I just don't have it. And I don't want to invent it. It's not there. And if it's not there, it's not there. So those were decisions I made. I found myself at times, I remember calling Tom Higgins, who is the owner and winemaker of the outstanding Heart and Hands Wine Company on Cayuga Lake. And I called Tom when I was writing the chapter of him and his wife, Susan. And I called him and I said, well, you told me the story of this day, X, Y, and Z. Do you remember what you were wearing and what the color of the shirt was? And he was saying, boy, I don't know. I said, well, do you have any pictures? Can you go round it up? And this is where Greg will say, you're a little over-obsessive on the details, but I wanted all of the details. Mm-hmm. I'd rather have everything to have it at my disposal. And I had one reader say, boy, you were really obsessed with hairstyles and what people were wearing. And maybe I overwrote it, but I wanted to write very descriptively to paint images in people's minds, and I didn't feel like I could do it unless I knew.
And you had a tougher task because you were writing other people's stories. We get to tell our own stories, mm-hmm. so it's easier.
Yeah. But I felt like, if I was going to mention the color of a shirt or what someone was wearing or beat up shoes, et cetera, I had to know. Yep. Right. And if I didn't know, I didn't want to write it. Mm-hmm. And so is an obsession over those details, was I a little silly? Because I spent a lot of time on that. And I don't know if it was
too much.
It was the first time I've read it.
I think it ultimately made your book the solid piece that it's respected for. So kudos to you.
Yeah, but you're a writing teacher, and I know you do tell people you don't have to obsess over whether this shirt was perfectly blue.
I don't.
Or
I try to say to the best of your memory, mm-hmm. You know, be in the scene. Remember, you know, if I don't remember what I was wearing that day, what kinds of things did I wear in seventh grade? I remember that. I fortunately have a pretty darn good memory, so I can come up with that stuff. And I have 300,000 pictures in my basement in boxes and all kinds of things. So I can supplement where I need to. But when I'm asked that question, I ask people to do the best to their memory, be in the scene, go there, and write about it.
Okay. Well, it's enough of the interrogating the host, okay? I appreciate that, Greg Girard, turning it around on the host. Let's get a short break. We're late for a break. We're going to come back. Elizabeth Ost to pose the question, why do we read memoirs? And I want to ask our group of authors why they chose to write their stories. They all have these diverse and interesting stories, and I want to get into that and talk about how they have chosen to do that after this short break as we explore the genre of memoir this hour on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson on The Next Connections. It's Arts Friday, and we preview a couple of summer arts festivals, the Cornhill Arts Festival, with a new emphasis on music this year. We'll tell you why. And we'll also talk about another art festival that is moving from Canandaigua to Webster. After a bit of a dramatic turn, we'll talk about why there's a new home for the Waterfront Park Arts Festival. That's all coming up on Arts Friday.
The U.S. and China are close economic partners, which makes assigning blame over a recent U.S. data breach all the more complicated.
It's hard to sort of pin down who you should be blaming, and if you leave all of the blame at Beijing's doorstep, is that really the right place?
Pointing fingers or not, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our conversation this hour was inspired by Elizabeth Gilbert's article in the New York Times Magazine this week, Confessions of a Seduction Addict. She's the author of Eat, Pray, Love, one of the most successful memoirs ever. and her story. She kind of expands on her personal story there. And I thought, what better time to talk about the rules of memoir and why we read what we read and what our expectations as readers are and what they should be. Because it's, you know, we read all year long, but it's a great summer reading season. A couple weeks from now, it's going to be Summer Book Week on Connections. What are you reading this summer? My colleague Scott Feibusch is going to be in for me on the week of July 20th through the 23rd with a special Summer Book Week on this show. He's going to talk with publishers, booksellers, and authors, including David McCullough on his new book, The Wright Brothers. And we want you to read along with us starting July 20th on Connections. By next week, we think we're going to have the full list of the books if you want to try to get reading in advance so you can follow along with Scott that week. So we're thinking about what we read. We read a lot of memoir. And I want to ask our panel why they write what they write and what they're writing what they're writing. So Elizabeth Osta, you're the recent author of an Irish historical novel, Jeremiah's Hunger, but you're currently writing a memoir, Saving Faith, about your years in a convent. Mm-hmm. And you pose the question, why do we read memoirs, but why are you writing that story?
I'm writing that story because of the number of questions that have come to me about those years that I spent in the convent. I wrote a vignette because I had some very funny experiences, and that vignette triggered memories for me that I've completely forgotten about, and I thought, maybe this is worth exploring. And I'm writing to remember, and that's often what happens for me. Mm-hmm. Often people say, why did you enter the convent? And then their next question is, why did you leave the convent? So I answer, read the book.
Well, that's a convenient thing to say now. How long ago was it, those years?
1968 to 77.
And how much work have you had to do to try to recover your memory in various ways?
Lots. Very tumultuous time. And that's one of the things that happened when I started writing it. I realized how tumultuous those times were. So it's taking me a longer time than I ever anticipated.
What have you had to do?
Well, I've gone back to the impact of the closing of the Catholic schools in the city of Rochester. It's been a very big issue that I didn't realize was as big an issue, particularly now because there's so little Catholic presence in the country in many ways, except for Pope Francis. He's bringing it back. And also I had to do a lot of archive work. I went back to the Sisters of St. Joseph. I was here in Rochester, and they have a wonderful archivist who helped me remember days and dates and people and times, and even the dress at the time. The habits were changing, so I got the dates when those all happened.
Very good. And the book is due out when? When do you think?
I'm hoping within the year.
Within the year. Elizabeth Osta, Saving Faith is the working title. Mm-hmm. Will you self-publish? What's the process?
That's
plan?
Part of within the year.
We'll find out. Jenny Lloyd is a retired history professor from the College at Brockport, author of one book, four scholarly articles, and writing about her life off and on for 25 years. Why don't you tell the story about your own memoir and why you chose to write it?
Well, it all started when I took a class in autobiography at Writers and Books with a woman called Finn Drury. And it became, that's actually where I met Elizabeth. And it became an addiction for those who took the class. And we took
careful, we've been talking about addiction. Yes. I don't know if it's a measurable addiction.
And we took it until Finn retired. And I found that I liked writing about myself, which I had never done before. And so I wrote autobiographical pieces and memoir pieces on and off for a while. Then when I was writing my academic book, I didn't, because I couldn't do both. It's a completely different voice. And then came back to it and started to actually try and make a memoir. And I particularly wanted to write about growing up with my parents. Eccentric middle-class people eccentrically decided at the end of World War II to buy a farm. They were not farmers. They didn't know anything about farming. And we moved to the farm. And I wanted to write about why they did that, what it was like to do that, and also my experiences in boarding school, because I went to boarding school when I was 5. So those are the things I wanted to write about.
What has been the challenge of recovering those details?
Recovering the details, not much of a challenge. I remember them very well.
Wow. The
challenge has been more to not to write it as an academic. Sonia was a great help to me in that. And and to decide what to put in and what to leave out.
Mm-hmm. Are you writing it for you? Are you writing it for an audience?
Well, I do have an audience in my family. I have no idea who else would want to read this.
The people at this table are raising their hands. But
they've read it.
Now, Sonia Livingston's first book is Ghost Bread. It's a memoir set in Rochester. Won the Association of Writers Prize for Nonfiction and is being taught in classrooms around the country is what we hear,
yes.
Sonia. So usually as the author of this program, I don't have authors on unless I've read your book, and I've only read Greg's book. So I'm actually feeling, I feel kind of
guilty,
bereft of responsibility at this hour. Yes,
it's fine,
I do.
It's fine.
But Sonia, tell me about Ghost Bread.
Well, Ghost Bread is a book about growing up in Rochester and in Western New York. I write about living as one of seven children in a family headed by a single mom, and write about living on a Native American reservation and outside of Buffalo, and just my experiences. And why did I write it? I wrote it, first of all, because I like to write. I think if I weren't a writer, I wouldn't have wanted to do this just because I wanted to tell the story. But writing is the art that sort of fits for me. And also I wanted to shine a light. It's funny, I write about growing up poor, but as a kid, I hid that so much. It was so embarrassing, and I held on to it and never spoke it. And I think sometimes those things that we hold on to so tightly become sort of work their way up to the surface. Mm-hmm. And so when I was about 30, everything I started to write was about my background. And I found that people connected to it and wanted to hear a little bit more about these families that we hear so much about and maybe see walking down the street but don't really know how they're functioning. So my motivation was twofold. I'm a writer. And secondly, I wanted to shine a light on a population that I think is hidden.
Yeah. So again, you grew up where?
I went to East High School, grew up in the northeast section of Rochester, moved around a lot, like lots of kids in the city, East Main Street, Lamont Place, which is near Goodman Plaza.
And so this is where I'm trying to kind of get inside your head a bit. And this is where I'm really eager to read your work, because you say you grew up and you were embarrassed about being poor.
Oh, yeah.
But you grew up in an area where you weren't the only poor person.
I wasn't the only poor person, but I was one of the few white poor people. And somehow I think that made a difference when I went to school. I was in classes. A lot of the classes had other white kids, or they came from different neighborhoods, or maybe I was just more sensitive. But yeah, I'm sure that I fooled no one, Evan, but I really did not want anyone to know that I was poor. And like I said, it's funny how then I write a whole book about it later. And then another one. I have another one just out that sort of hits those same topics. So
Queen of the Fall.
Queen of the Fall, which is about, it's also set in Rochester, but really about girls and women and sort of their experiences.
And Queen of the Fall just selected for 2016 If All of Rochester Reads
yeah.
program. I mean, that is a huge
That's great.
Honor.
It's a huge honor.
That's through Writers and Books. So all, mm-hmm. If All of Rochester Reads, the same book. So Queen of the Fall will be the book. When did that selection get made?
I think maybe 3 weeks ago or something.
Wow.
It's really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That means I get to read more of your work because you're going to be back on this program talking about it.
Yeah, yeah. That sounds great.
When you write a book like Ghost Bread, and again, the title of Ghost Bread signifies what?
It's a kind of bread that was made on the Tonawanda Indian Reservation. The Seneca, the Iroquois make it. When somebody sees a gogosa or a ghost, they made this bread. And the food apart from that ghost bread was pretty bad. And I'm a kid who really liked food. And to have soup every day was terrible. So I prayed for this ghost bread. I prayed somebody would see a ghost so we'd get this bread. And so the title really comes from the name of that bread, but also the idea of longing that isn't necessarily fulfilled, both physical and emotionally.
Did you write it for you or did you write it for an audience?
I wrote it for both. It's funny, writing memoir is something that I love to do, but it's also a difficult thing. It's not necessarily easy to sort of go back and put yourself in those places, or at least it isn't for me. So for both, I certainly hope that people will read it.
Greg Girard's book, In Jupiter's Shadow, one of a number of his books, and Greg writes in multiple genres. We talked about it on this program, but Greg, In Jupiter's Shadow encompasses your childhood, so it goes back a few years now. Don't mean to date you. Did you have, when you decided to write this book, did you have any challenges sort of recovering your own details or memories, and how did you go about it?
I was the little kid who was watching the Waltons, and I wanted to be John Boy. I wanted to be sitting in that window writing the stories about what I heard and saw and the things around me. So I was a journaler from way little kid. So I have all those journals. And the theme of this particular story emerged with a desire to share with kids who are probably struggling in the same way, or people that might be struggling in the same way that I struggled with sexuality and religion in conflict. As far as pulling up the material for it, I have all those journals. The original spark of inspiration was a letter I wrote to God in 1985. When I was sitting down at Ellison Park, I decided not to go to church, which was a big no-no for a Catholic. And instead, I went to Ellison Park and I wrote this letter to God. It was on the back of a Tops check application, which just happened to be in the garbage, and I didn't have any paper. And I said, "Dear God, I'm gay, and I don't know what to do about it because I'm told that it's not okay." And so that was the spark that started me writing. And I again took some classes with writers and books and got involved with a writing group, and the stories came out. But as far as pulling the facts together, I do feel blessed with a pretty darn good memory, so I was able to. It was actually fun to write scenes because I would be able to go back and be in that time. Mm. And I would spend a whole evening from after dinner until 11 o'clock locked away in my writing studio being in 1978 and remembering, you know, Sister Helen and all kinds of fun things that happened.
And in many ways, you write for you, but you wrote for an audience that, because I know you have thought about kids who were just like you right now growing up.
I do, and I think that it persists today. We just heard last week the Catholic bishops say that the SCOTUS ruling on Friday for marriage equality for all is a tragic error. That's what they labeled that. And I'm so offended by that. I want to share my voice, my experience, to say, hey, when you say these things, they affect more than consenting adults.
What do you think should happen with your book now? Now that you've had a chance to publish it, you know, I mean, this is a moment, I think, because of all these things that are happening. What's next for In Jupiter's Shadow?
I had this idea that's been brewing for a while, so I just launched a GoFundMe campaign. I'm interested in actually sending it to all of the U.S. Catholic leadership, somewhat in response to this SCOTUS opinion, and also because there's an upcoming Catholic Synod in October. And they're going to be making decisions about the family, and they're going to be making decisions about homosexuality, and we have a new pope in line. So I'm looking to share that experience. There's 277 of them, so that's why I decided I needed a GoFundMe campaign to help make that happen. So that's my next thought, is to help change minds and hearts, if I can, or, you know, at least let them make informed decisions. If you're going to make a decision that affects people, make sure you know what those people's story is before you make a decision that affects them.
And because I asked, is the GoFundMe campaign up and running now?
It is. It just opened this week.
You're allowed to tell it. Go ahead.
My website, jupitershadow.com, will give you the link to get to the GoFundMe.
Okay. Before I wrap up, I want to read a comment that came in, and I think it brings up a couple of points, and this is from Harriet. She says, "Evan, truth, you've got to be kidding. Really, how many histories have been written, loved, respected, and honored where the author was not present, among many other problems of proximity? And memoirs, there's a reason that Jeanette Walls, David Sedaris, and Elizabeth Gilbert have made an impact. The details of their stories resonate hugely with readers, and the prose is the key. It seems like the idea of truth is vague at best with your panel." Is that fair? I don't think truth is vague at best.
No.
Especially not with Jenny. Jenny is the most extreme adherent here.
Well, as I was just saying to a class yesterday, truth is always filtered through someone's mind.
Right.
Historians are people, and it's their take, not somebody else's, which is why you get thousands of books on the same topic. I think for most historians, not all postmodern historians, but most historians, there is something that is the truth up there, but it's totally unattainable. You can't get to the truth. We'd all tell different stories about what happened here today, and who knows which one. There isn't a right one.
Right. And do people want the right one? I mean, let's say that they wanted the truth. They could get a transcript of our lives. How boring would that be?
Exactly.
I think people,
yes.
It's not a weakness that, you know, we are telling our stories through our filter. People are hungry to connect with us because of that filter. So even though I don't think I've said that I don't adhere to the truth, I don't tend to use that word, because what is the truth? Instead, I say truth of my perception.
Sure. Yes. And just to kind of go back to technique, I took a digital recorder with me when I was writing, mm-hmm. and recorded many, many, many hours of conversation, and the only editing out I did on the quotations I chose were the ums and uhs. That's it. I did, but I admit, I took out the ums and uhs. Yeah. So it reads very cleanly because nobody quite speaks that well, but that's it. And then Harriet also raises one other point that I think is fair. She says, do we have a problem with Elizabeth Gilbert because she confessed in the recent New York Times bit about seduction that she had behaved as badly as many men have, and we always give women a much harder time for this behavior? Harriet, I think you're right.
I agree.
I think women are treated differently. I think men, well, that's expected, and I didn't intend to do that. And that's, I think, what Elizabeth Gilbert did before and during her marriage, and maybe a little after her marriage, would have been wrong for either gender. But I do take the point, though, that maybe we react a little bit more stringently when it's a woman. So, yeah, Harriet, I think I'm guilty about that. Mm-hmm. So that's what we have to do. We have to own it when we're wrong. Thank you, Harriet. Thanks to a great panel. And Greg, you get the last word, because if people are out there listening and thinking about writing, there are great classes. This is a great writers group that you have here. But what are the resources? You've got 20 seconds or so. Where do you want to send them to think about getting started?
If you're here in Rochester, check out Writers and Books, WAB.org. Definitely get in touch with a writing group. Find your friends from high school or from wherever, the cafe, that like to write. Look on the bulletin boards at places like Writers and Books. Find people who like to write and get with them.
Well said. Greg Girard, author, among other things, of In Jupiter's Shadow. Jenny Lloyd, author of, do we have a title yet, Jenny?
Unfortunately, no. I'm struggling with that.
Come back sometime and tell us about it, how it turns out.
I'd love to.
Elizabeth Osta, the forthcoming memoir, Saving Faith. Nice to see you. And Sonia Livingston, Ghostbred, Queen of the Fall. Third book of nonfiction, Ladies' Night at the Dreamland, is also coming out next spring.
Next spring.
You've got quite a busy slate.
I know. I need a life, huh?
Thanks to all of you for a wonderful hour of discussion. I appreciate it.
Thanks,
Evan. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
And thanks for listening to Member-Supported Public Radio. I'm Evan Dawson.